Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about The Great Scientists, a coffee table book. And I think the further back where there's less information and they have to write more, there's sort of a dangerous filler and lack of knowledge that sort of feel almost Photoshop-y in these ancient scientists and ascribe to them modern values, trying to make sense of an ancient world. So they're saying, hey, if you don't understand the ancient world, these scientists also didn't understand the ancient world. They're just like you, so you accept scientists, this type of stuff. So we've come back. I just think the last one is Van Leeuwenhoek, the Dutch person, the Dutch microscope maker. I don't know whether you'd technically call him a scientist in all this. He did work of scientific import, and he did have some qualities. It's almost, I say, what are the essential qualities? Behind that is another Dutch chap. I'm just trying to think. Huygens. Now, Huygens was a dapper man of the Enlightenment. And we're coming on to Robert Hooke. H-O-O-K-E. Robert Hooke, 1635 to 1703. So that's fairly easy. That's 65 and 3, 68 years. We now expect to live longer than this. Is one of the great unsung heroes of science. No, he was destroyed by Newton. Newton, in his bizarre, macabre world, decided that he was going to crush, besides see people, he was going to crush people. Sort of like this bizarre monster from the Renaissance living into the Enlightenment. But he made crucial contributions to almost every branch of the scientific revolution of the 17th century, yet he remains a shadowy, little-known figure. Dear, this... it really doesn't describe it. He was... is he a humanist? I don't know. He was certainly not supported and counseled to deal with the likes of Newton. Let's read about this. Most people know of Hooke's name only because of the law of elasticity. Hooke's law of elasticity, that if you extend the length of a spring 10 centimetres, it's 10 newtons. If you extend it another 20 centimetres, it will be 20 newtons. That's Hooke's law. And so if you extend it infinitely, it will be infinitely strong. So it only works for a different way. How things stretch or squeeze, which bears his name, Hooke's law. This basically says that the force with which any springy material bounces back when squeezed or stretched depends on the force used to... depends on the force used to squeeze or stretch it. Oh, I think they've bucked that up. They're saying the distance. Yeah, this is an important law, but it's just one tiny example of Hooke's overall contribution to science. So they've stuffed that up. So it says the displacement of a springy material is proportional to the strength of the displacement. No force, no displacement. Displace it one unit of force. Displace it two units of force. The sheer range of Hooke's activities is quite astonishing, and some experts have described it as the English Leonardo da Vinci. He's perhaps, the most practical and inventive of all great scientists, and his range of inventions matches, if not surpasses, his theoretical ideas. Oh my God, that really is sort of almost on the realms of sheer vomit listening to that. Isn't that just appalling? Among Hooke's many inventions is the ear trumpet, the first practical spirit level, sash windows. Oh, is that sash windows? Balancing escapement of clocks. So, was that Huygens' things? The aerometer for measuring wind speed, the hygrometer for measuring humidity, the wheel barometer for showing how air pressure varies, the crosshair for sights and telescopes, and later gun sights, the iris diaphragm, later the aperture for cameras, micro dots, for secret messages, respirators for ease of breathing, yeah. Diving bell, air pump, the universal joint, narrowly used to drive car shafts, self-stabilizing keel of a boat, and early form of sonar, mercury amalgam, used for dental fillings, the micrometer, the air gun, and the list goes on. And now someone back there invented the vernier. I'm just trying to really remember some really important... Oh, was it Leonardo da Vinci? Who invented the vernier? I can't really remember. I just wish... I'll have to go back. And like Leonardo, Hooke worked on flying machines and even anticipated the coming of the steam engine. The steam engine was actually built in Alexandrian times in ancient Rome. Not for nothing did his friend, the famous John Aubrey, describe him as, quote, certainly the greatest mechanic this day in the world. But Hooke was by no means just an ingenious technician. He was also a visionary scientist. He is known to have collaborated with the most great scientists of the day, Boyle, Newton, Huygens, Leeuwenhoek, Wren, and many others, and clearly contributed a great deal to their work. But much of the record of Hooke's work is lost, so his contribution was not always clear or recognised, even at the time. Wasn't lost, obliterated by a vindictive Newton, I've got to say. Some, like Boyle, freely acknowledge Hooke's valuable role in helping formulate his famous gas law. Newton, however, fought long and bitterly with Hooke over who came up with the crucial idea that the force of gravity diminishes as the square distance between things, the universe square law. This evidence points in Hooke's favour, but Newton effectively obliterated the record of Hooke's role in the work. I think you have to understand that Newton was a damaged person. His mother abandoned him. Children taunted him at school, not being loved, and he just flipped. He cracked. He was a cracked person. In some areas, though, Hooke's contribution is incontestable. It's not uncontestable. Incontestable. It's uncontestable. Or incontestable, not capable of being contested. He was the great pioneer of microscope studies, coining the word cell for the microscopic packaging in which all living things are built. No, he describes cell for what he saw, and we later realised his book, Micrographia, was the greatest book of the age on the microscopic world, and an inspiration for men as diverse as Leeuwenhoek and diarist Samuel Pelps. He was also the founder of the science of meteorology, showing how to measure atmospheric quantities like wind, speed, air pressure, suggesting how accurate record keeping could lead to weather forecasting. As if all this wasn't enough, Hooke was a major architect, not only collaborating with Sir Christopher Wren in the rebuilding of London after the Great Fire of 1666, but designing many buildings in his own right. The famous Monument of the Fire of London, the world's tallest Greek-style column, is thought to have been designed by him. So too was the Great Palace at Bethlehem Hospital, now destroyed, and maybe the famous Whispering Gallery in St. Paul's Cathedral too. I don't think the Whispering Gallery was a design thing. It was a freak thing. There's a Whispering Wall Dam in South Australia. It's a beautiful dam. Young Hooke. Well, that's how it can go. Robert Hooke was born in 18th of July, 1635, at Freshwater on the Isle of Wight. He later described his early childhood as charmed and trouble-free, but in fact, he was marred by smallpox, which left him scarred for life. His mother is nowhere mentioned in later recollections. But look, mums are a major problem with scientists. And I think that means that they're not suited for society, so they're kept on the outside. And if they're smart enough, that lack of acceptance by society generates the scientists. I wonder if that's actually through to today, that the more we try to make STEM scientists, the more we make sort of moderate, churn them out scientists. We don't make the specialist STEM scientists. I wonder if that's true today. He seems to have spent a lot of time wandering the chalk landscape of the Isle of Wight, which he may have gained his first knowledge of fossils. The great tragedy in young Robert's childhood happened when he was just 11 years old. This was the suicide of his clergyman father, who lost his living in the wake of the Royalist defeat of the English Civil War. So there you go. Suicide, tragedy, similar happening in Newton's life. Robert was left with a small legacy of £40, maybe with the help of neighbours, or maybe entirely on his own initiative. He travelled to London to enrol as an apprentice in the studio of England's most accomplished painter, Peter Lely, whose famous portraits of Charles I are royalist. Later, after a year or so, in which he learned valuable drawing skills, he decided he needed a proper education and used the legacy to enrol at Westminster School. School's formidable headmaster, Richard Busby, recognised him as something special on his hand. When the 13-year-old Robert read all of Euclid's works in a week, now, I don't know. Euclid's works is not like a Encyclopedia Britannica. It's not, as far as I know, not very thick. Busby became the young Hooth's patron and helped ensure he progressed to Oxford University, where he was paid his way with a choral scholarship. It was while at Oxford in late 1650 that Hooke met the famous Irish chemist Robert Boyle, with the ingenious design of air pump, which allowed Boyle to show as gas was compressed the pressure increases in proportion, and so formulate his famous gas law, P equals NRT. Hooke's design provided the basis for the design of air pumps even today. That is Hooke's law, the N, Avogadro's number. The Royal Society. It's interesting how the Royal Society developed. It's beginning to be terrain now. Boyle and Hooke formed the nucleus of the brilliant scientists at Gresham College in Oxford, who were to create the world's most famous society, the Royal Society. Now, Francis Bacon led to the Royal Society, so I don't quite work out how this goes. When the Society was launched in 1662, so I think it was Bacon's, Boyle ensured that Hooke was appointed as the first curator of experiments. This post, which for many years was unpaid, meant that Hooke was expected to give practical experiments at every meeting of the Society. It's hard to imagine anyone but Hooke being willing to fulfil such an arduous brief, or making such an astonishing success of it. In response to the Society's demand, Hooke came up with a greater wealth of original scientific ideas and practical demonstrations than anyone before and since. And I have to say, not that my dad's in the same league, but he was Australia's first computer programmer, and the interface between the computers and the scientists, and his mind solved a lot of dramatic early problems like the first databases and matrix solutions and things like that. So it's interesting that very similar side support. So as a side support doing that, you've got Faraday supporting who was it? Davy, this type of stuff. It seemed to suit Hooke's agile mind to leap from one task to another and with amazing rapidity, but it may have been why he never developed any one single idea to the point where he became lastingly famous for it. At the same time, Hooke achieved worldwide fame with his published the fruits of his experimental work of microscopes and micrographia in 1665. But while he continued to contribute a seemingly endless stream of ideas to almost every field of science, he began to be increasingly bitter and isolated as other scientists started to take credit for the theory he had either suggested or proved with practical demonstrations. And I must admit, when I was the technical guru at the Optical Fibre Centre, a lot of things I invented were thanks very much, and there's the publication. And the battle with Newton. The bitterest dispute was with Newton. While Newton was made his theory of light of colour known in 1672, Hooke pointed out that it was right in Newton's theory had been suggested by him 7 years previously. He also argued that light did not travel as particles but waves, an idea credited to the Dutch scientist Huygens. The battle lines began to be drawn between these giants of science. Well, yeah, this is the entire thing. It's so hard to manage in a research organisation. When Newton first mentioned his idea of gravity in the 1680s, he suggested gravity was a constant, that is, the same strength everywhere. Hooke suggested that the elliptical course of the planet's orbits might be better explained if gravity was not constant, but obeyed the square law, diminishing as the square of the distance to objects. But, of course, Hooke had no proof of his idea, even though a decade earlier he made important observations to prove it using the Zenith telescope in his rooms at Oxford. In response, Hooke's publication, Newton wrote his great book, Principia, over the next few years, in which he proved mathematical proofs that gravity does indeed obey the inverse square law. So there you go. As Newton came to the point of publishing Principia, Hooke insisted at the Royal Society that he be properly credited with his idea of the theoretical cornerstone of Newton's work. Newton was incensed and immediately deleted virtually all reference to Hooke in his book. In a famous riposte, Newton quoted the old Latin rhetorical tag, "Merely because one says something could be so, it does not follow that it is so," implying that credit should go entirely to the scientists who proved the idea. Newton, by the time, was such a powerful figure and vindictive his view to Hooke stuck, and even today most people still go along with Newton's uncharitable view that the dilettante Hooke lacked the solid scientific and mathematical covert, the glimmerings of the theory of solid is solid until it's proven. In fact, sort of speaks to it, and it is a real important thing. Now, of course, the internet and patents and stuff like this goes. Final years. As Hooke grew older, as they want to do, he became increasingly depressed and withdrawn. This is not enough for Newton, though. So deep was Newton's hatred of Hooke, it is said, that when Hooke and Newton became president of the Royal Society, he destroyed the portraits of Hooke that hung there. By the time he reached his 60s, Hooke was a physical and emotional wreck. Some of this was undoubtedly down to the stress in the Battle of Newton, but a lot was self-inflicted. He had lived a punishing pace all his life, working through the night after night on experiments. He tried many experiments on his own bodies, and they had taken their toll. Moreover, to keep up the impossible pace he set himself, he stuffed himself again and again with stimulant drugs. It couldn't last. In his final months were a time of physical deterioration. The isolation is one of his friends fell away, as one by one his fellows fell away. Unable to cope with his bouts of paranoia, he died alone in Gresham College rooms on the 3rd of March, 1703, attended only by a young maid. Isn't that sad? And there are old people, old soldiers in Penrith, attended only by their old people. It's a very sad thing. So, Macrographia, this is a sign. When Hooke published his great book, Macrographia, it caused an immediate sensation and was perhaps the most popular science book in history, perhaps. Famous diarist Phelps obtained a copy as soon as he could and wrote, quote, "Before I went to bed, I sat up until 2 o'clock in my chamber reading Mr. Hooke's Macrographic Observations, the most ingenious book I had ever read in my life." Hooke was probably the first scientist to use the microscope to study the microscopic detail, probably. Using a first-class compound microscope he made himself, he studied organisms versus insect sponges and formulifera. Micrographia is meticulous in its detailed record of his observation and includes his own superb drawings of what he saw through the microscope. He was the first to see clearly such things as scales on the fleas of a body as the hairs on a fly's legs. His most famous observation was a thin slice of cork, at which he wrote, "I could exceedingly plainly perceive it to be all perforated and porous, much like a honeycomb, but the pores were regular. The pores, or cells, were indeed the first microscopic pores I ever saw and perhaps have ever seen." In fact, as we know, discovered living cells. Well, they're not living cells, are they? Because it's a dead piece of cork. And the main thing about cork is that it's got to be dried and the cells deteriorate and come out. Hooke also studied fossils and noted the similarities between petrified wood and fossil shells and living wood and living shells, and went on to make the first description of the process of fossilization, in which minerals gradually replace living tissues and turn the dead organisms into stone. He later went even further, suggesting that seashell fossils found in the high mountains indicate the past world was subject to massive earthquakes that threw up ancient seabeds to form mountains. Hooke even thought that some of the fossils might be of species creatures that no longer existed. Well, that's a bit rich. Such ideas were ahead of their time and probably inaccurate in the way that they're put. It only came to prominence with the Great Revolution that transformed geology and formed the basis of Darwin's theory of evolution almost 200 years later. It's a very interesting thing. I really wish kids had microscopes as a general thing. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.